coming up.
What do you really want to know? Am I sorry for what I did?
Well, I am.
As not a day goes by, I don't feel regret.
If I regret something wrong I have done, do I have to regret everything good that wrong might have led to?
I look back on the way I was then. A young, stupid kid who committed that terrible crime. I want to talk to him. I want to try to talk some sense to him.
Can't I regret the sin, but love the result of the sin?
Yeah, it's like, why cry over spilt milk?
Our guest is Jay Wallace, author of The View from Here, on affirmation, attachment, and the limits of regret.
To value someone, to be attached to a person, is to be vulnerable to regret.
The logic of regret, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thank you for being a Philosophy Talk partner.
We're grateful for your past support. We need you to stand up and help us again, now more than ever. And you can do so just by heading over to the Philosophy Talk webpage and clicking that big I will help button. And believe me, it will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford University campus across the bay. That's where Ken teaches philosophy and I did for 40 wonderful years.
And now you're a turncoat and teach at Berkeley Park.
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today, we're thinking about regret.
Well, Ken, the dictionary defines regret. I looked it up as a feeling of sadness, repentance, or disappointment over something that's happened or has been done, especially a lost or missed opportunity. That's straightforward. Straightforward human emotion. How are you going to get a puzzle or a problem out of that?
John, there are tons of puzzles about regret, but think about this one. Ask yourself, is it ever actually rational to regret the past? You can't change the past. So why waste time feeling sad and disappointed about it?
Well, because regret can motivate you to own up to the consequences of the past and do something about it. Say I forget your birthday. I can't change that, but I can do the next best thing. I give you a nice gift to make up for it. Maybe a first edition of something by Derrida.
Oh, that's so sweet of you. Now, okay, how's that work? You're trying to suggest that, although you know you can't change what you did, you want me to know that you would if you could, as if that's going to make up for it.
Well, yeah, if I had it to do over again, I would have paid attention to Facebook, noticed your birthday was coming up, and sent you a nice message. No bad feelings on your part, and I get to keep my first edition of Derrida.
Okay, so let's see. What do you think about that? That shows, I think that does show something. It shows that regret is not just a simple emotion, the way your dictionary definition seemed to imply, because, you know, it involves something much more complicated than an emotion. It involves what we philosophers might call a conditional intent. If you had it to do over, you would do things differently. That's part of the nature of regret.
Well, that seems right. Okay. Conditional intent, I'll buy that.
Yeah, but just think about this a little bit. That's going to lead us directly to a paradox, I think.
A paradox?
Yeah. Think about this. Consider a hypothetical case. Okay, years ago, you and your lovely wife, Frenchie, were supposed to visit, I don't know, your favorite aunt of yours. She was quite ill. She was dying to see you while she was still well, while she still could. But, John, you forgot all about her. She was quite upset when you didn't show up. She was wondering where you were. She, against her doctor's orders, she got out of bed. She went to call you, but on the way, she fell down and died. Now, how would you feel about that?
Well, of course, I would never do anything like that. But had I done that, I would have felt terrible about it then, and I would regret it to this very day.
That means that if you could change the events of that day, you would, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, but now, suppose that night, that was the very night that your oldest son, Jim, was conceived.
I remember that night.
Yeah, Jim. Jim wouldn't have existed without the exact combination of events leading to that exact sperm and that exact egg meeting with that exact DNA that makes Jim, Jim.
I see where you're going.
Yeah, good, good, because you don't regret Jim's existence, right?
No, I'm one of the things I'm happiest about in the world. Quite the opposite, I affirm his existence.
Okay, so that means you wouldn't do anything, even if you could, to change that day so that he never existed, right?
Of course not.
No, but see, now you're in a pickle, John. You regret not visiting your aunt, right? You killed her, right? You regret that.
Well, I regret not visiting her, I'll give you that.
So you would undo that day if you could, right?
Well, maybe.
But then, John, no Jim. Yeah. Yet you affirm Jim's existence and wouldn't undo that day, even if you could. So you've got yourself in a paradox here. You both would and would not change the past if you could.
Well, wait a minute. I think you're depending on a principle that's not so obvious. If I regret something, do I really have to regret all of its consequences? And if I affirm something, do I have to affirm all of the events that were necessary for it to occur?
Of course you do. It's just a matter of logic. If you don't, it's either bad faith or magical thinking. It's magical thinking to affirm the effects of your present life without affirming the causes, the bad things you did that led to your present life. You can't have it both ways. It's magical thinking if you try to do it.
You know, Ken, I smell a little Nietzsche here. I think you're trying to lead me down a garden path of your hero, Nietzsche. To affirm my life, I have to think that if I had it to live over again, I would do everything the same, not regretting any of it, no matter how loathsome certain part of it might have been.
You got it.
And if we were to push that line, can I not only not regret the bad things I've done, if I affirm my life and my existence, I can't regret any of the terrible things in the past that led to my life and my existence. You wouldn't be able to regret slavery because your parents and their parents and so forth, they wouldn't have come together if it hadn't been for slavery. And I can't regret the Irish potato famine.
No.
Because without the Irish potato famine, my great-great-grandfathers wouldn't have ended up in America.
Exactly, John. Now you get it. Now you see. Now, regret isn't just some simple, normal human emotion. It's a really puzzling phenomenon, really puzzling.
Well, the problems about and puzzles about regret actually start, Ken, at the very beginning of life. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, out to explore how childhood regret can actually be an important tool for development. She files this report.
When I was in kindergarten, I really wanted to be friends with this girl named Rita. One day she comes up to me at recess and asks if I want to play with her. I am beyond thrilled. We're hanging out on the playground when this tall, kind of awkward girl comes up to us and asks to play with us too. Rita says no and walks away. The other girl looks like she's about to cry, but I follow Rita anyway. To this day, I regret following Rita. I confessed this story to my friend Yalda the other day. She told me her first regret story. She was about 6 years old at the time.
I have a memory of playing in the playground with lots of children, and then I started hearing a chanting.
Yalda didn't understand what the kids were chanting, but she joined along. She wanted to fit in.
And then all of a sudden, I just remember this crowd parting, like water, just parting, and two children walking hand in hand, an older boy and a girl that was probably about my age, and their heads were down. And I looked at their faces, and as soon as I looked at their faces, my heart sank because I realized that the chanting was for them and that it wasn't nice.
The kids were chanting, "You're a poo-poo face."
That's when I realized the color of their skin. I think they were either from Haiti or African. I just stood there and watched. I didn't do anything. I didn't help them. But I do now, in hindsight, especially regret that I didn't help them. I didn't do anything. I wasn't there.
These memories of regret seem to linger in us forever. And they really suck. Regret is icky and dark and weighs you down. It's better to live by the motto, no regrets, right?
I would tend to disagree with the motto, no regrets. Because I personally believe regrets are important because they prompt us to change our decision-making behavior, you know, in the future so that we will become more successful.
That's Emer O'Connor, a psychology research fellow at Queen's University in Belfast. O'Connor conducted a series of experiments to see how regret affects the future decision-making skills of 6 and 7-year-old children. First, she had kids choose between two boxes and told them each had tokens in them.
One with one token inside and the other with 10 tokens inside. Now, regardless of which box the child chose in the regret trial, they always received just the one token. And then I would open up the unchosen box and show that they could have won 10 tokens had they chosen that box.
Most kids genuinely regretted losing out on those 10 tokens. Then, during the second day of the study, O'Connor once again places two boxes in front of the children. Except this time they're given an extra token and a choice. They can pick the same box as the day before for free, or they can pay one token and choose the other box.
So they'll lose one token in order to win 10 tokens. We found that children who experienced regret on day one were significantly more likely to adapt their decision-making on day two to win the largest number of tokens, whereas children who did not report experiencing regret on day one did not tend to show that profitable decision-making or adaptive switching on day two.
The kids who felt regret made better choices the next day. So regret can be a good thing. But that doesn't mean we should all sit around ruminating over our past misdeeds. O'Connor says that can lead to depression.
I guess overall a balance is needed, really, whereby we learn from our mistakes and we move on.
Back in kindergarten, I regretted being mean to a girl at the playground, and it taught me to be more inclusive. I still feel like a jerk about it to this day, but maybe I shouldn't. Maybe Emer O'Connor is right. We gotta feel regret, learn, and then move right along. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thank you, Shuka, for that interesting report. I must say, if I were a psychologist and a little kid broke into tears when I showed them the box they hadn't chosen, I would feel regret. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher from Stanford, Ken Taylor. And we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
Our guest today teaches just a stone's throw away from here. He's a professor of philosophy at the UC Berkeley. He's author of The View from Here on Affirmation, Attachment, and the Limits of Regret. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Jay Wallace.
Okay, Jay, first question. Why the big interest in regrets? You have an unusual number of regrets in your life, do you?
I like to think that I don't. So it's not because I have a lot to regret myself. I think maybe one thing that got me into this topic is just observing amongst my acquaintances a diversity of attitudes toward the past. There are people who kind of never look back. They just always look forward. They don't get tormented by things mm-hmm. that have happened in the past. And then I know other people who are constantly second-guessing things they've done in the past and seem mired in regret. And you reflect on those two attitudes, and neither of them seems appropriate in some sense. They're both problematic. The one is kind of too superficial, and the other is the attitude of someone who never makes progress in life. And that just raises a big philosophical question. What is regret anyway, and are there ever conditions under which it's really the appropriate thing to feel?
In my mind, I'm going over your colleagues and putting them into...
I'm not going to attach any names to these people, but you know some of them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what's the point? Why should we feel regret at all? I mean, haven't you just written a book on an irrational emotion that we should just forget? If you already made a mistake, why pile on an extra negative feeling?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it's like, why cry over, you know, spilt milk?
Yeah.
You know, the psychologist's suggestion that we just heard about was an answer that's sort of like a conventional justification of punishment, right? Punishment is similar. It's like you do something bad to someone who's done something bad in the past. And one justification for that is that enhances the chance or the likelihood that they'll do better in the future. And that's one way you might go about justifying the tendency to regret.
So it's a kind of self-correction.
Kind of self-correction.
I mean, Mill says the saving grace of the human mind is that it's self-correcting, because we make all kinds of mistakes. But I wonder what you think. I mean, if there weren't any other people around. I mean, that's because those kids felt badly. So, but what if I did something I was on an island. I wanted to get the papaya. I chose a bad means. I could regret it, or I could just think, okay, next time I'll try something else.
Well, you
What's
know,
the point of the regret?
Yeah, if you go for this answer, you know, you'll keep choosing the bad papayas unless you're constitutionally susceptible to regret. I mean, having said this, I should also add that I think this forward-looking justification is a little too superficial.
You know, how so?
I think, really, regret is connected to a more profound human phenomenon that that really contributes a lot to the value of our lives, which is, you know, attachment or just being someone who values things. To value someone, to be attached to a person is, among other things, to be vulnerable to regret, to pain consciousness when things don't go well for the thing that you're attached to.
This is Philosophy Talk coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is Jay Wallace from UC Berkeley, and we're thinking about regrets.
If you regret something, do you have to regret all of its consequences? If you're happy about something, if you affirm it, if you're glad it's the way it is, do you have to affirm all the events that made it possible?
Regret, affirmation, and bad faith, along with questions from our audience, with no regrets, I hope, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Merci beaucoup to our musical guests, the Platons. Les Platons. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Jay Wallace from UC Berkeley. We're thinking together about regrets.
Do you have any long-standing regrets? Does acknowledging these regrets make you feel better or worse? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage. You won't regret it.
So now, I want to go back to the kind of puzzle John and I were talking about, because I think that's really interesting. I ask you, does it make sense to regret what seemed like a mistake at the time, like, you know, not calling the aunt, but led later to something that you are happy about and value, like John's son, Jim? I mean, what do you think about that kind of situation?
Yeah, I think that's a a central issue. That's kind of the central issue in some ways in my book. And one thing I think it might be helpful to do is to distinguish the two elements that you guys introduced in the beginning segment about regret. There's kind of the bad feeling. It's a kind of pained consciousness of something that happened in the past or something you've done. But there's also the intention aspect.
Yeah.
You wish that you hadn't done it. You wish that things had been different in that respect. And when it comes to that second element, I do think there's a kind of paradoxical situation where you can look back at something that was a mistake. You ought not to have done it at the time, but it's given rise to things that are the basis of what your life is about. And if you're in that situation, I submit that it doesn't make sense, or you can't really regret the mistake and decision that gave rise to the valuable things in your present life.
Well, now let me resist that a bit. Now, there's a familiar thing that comes from someplace in ethical philosophy. If you will the end, you got to will the means,
yeah.
Right? And that makes a certain amount of sense, because it's forward-looking, and you're not going to get to the end, the thing you have in
right.
mind, unless you're willing to do what's necessary to get there. And this is kind of the same principle
yeah.
In reverse. If you regret the event, you must regret its consequences. But I claim it's an illusion. Why is that so? It's just an attitude you have towards the event. You regret the event. Doesn't follow that you regret its consequences. It's like, if you like the smell of a rose, you must like the smell of the stem and the dirt that make it possible. Doesn't follow.
What about the
right?
other?
Just wait a bad principle. Drop it.
Wait a minute. What about the other? What about the other
side? Your
book
was unnecessary.
No.
What do you think about the other side? Suppose you affirm the consequence, right? You affirm being a bourgeois American,
mm-hmm.
right? You say, great life. Somebody says, this is what it took for mm-hmm. you to be. How can you not affirm that? Right. I mean, if you affirm the endpoint, mustn't you affirm what got you there?
My answer is no.
Aren't you being incoherent?
No, I mean, say, look, hey, I'm glad I'm in San Francisco. I moved there from Los Angeles. Well, aren't you glad you were in Los Angeles? Otherwise, you wouldn't have gotten to San Francisco. No, I didn't enjoy Los Angeles, but I enjoy San Francisco. No inconsistency. It's just an illusion. You're not regretting the whole possible world or some set of possible. You're just regretting the particular event.
You know, I think there's a principle of realism. You got to be realistic about the causal effects of your past decisions. And I think you form these conditional intentions about these counterfactuals in the past in the light of what you know about what the past events brought about. And I think there's a certain kind of condition of realism that forces you to see these things in connection with each other.
That's why I accuse you of magical thinking.
That's right.
I mean, it's Ken's like magical thinking. I get to have the goodies of being a bourgeois American, right? Oh, but, you know, I don't own that past. I got there. Come on, that's just magical thinking.
No, I mean, that's you're just importing a kind of a plausible-sounding principle about reasoning and maybe about planning, means and ends, to other emotions and attitudes to which it doesn't apply. I expect to enjoy the chocolate cake that I eat. I don't expect to enjoy the pounds I gain from it. Perfectly rational. Just because I'm not going to enjoy the pounds doesn't mean I won't enjoy the cake. Just because I enjoy the cake doesn't mean I have to enjoy getting fat.
I think the crucial thing, though, is that it's not just about enjoyment. It's something like intention. So when I put the question to you, do you wish you had gone to see your aunt in Ken's little anecdote, knowing that if you'd done so, your son wouldn't exist. And that those are the facts. That's a true counterfactual about...
Well, you're asking...
That's just the question.
I agree. Once you go the conditional intention route, you're in trouble. Well, so don't go that route. The question is not what would you do if you could do it over. You can't do it over again. The question is, do you think it was some defect in your character that led you to do it in the first place? Yes. It commits me to nothing.
I think regret and affirmation go deeper than that. They do involve these kind of conditional intentions about the past. That's what it is. That when Edith Piaf sings that she regrets nothing, she's affirming something like a commitment.
Yeah, but so principles that hold for Edith Piaf don't hold for ordinary mortals like us.
Let's go back. So tell me what you think regret is. I mean, John and I kind of, the dictionary defines it as this emotion of sadness. We kind of added this conditional intention kind of thing, which seems to me right, but I don't know if that's your... what's your theory of what it is? What is it to regret something?
Well, I think there are different kinds of regret. I think you can have regrets. People talk about that. Do you have any regrets? And, you know, to have regrets is a fairly superficial thing. It's just a matter of, you know, feeling a pained consciousness when you think about something in the past. And you can have that without the conditional intention. But I think there's a kind of regret, a kind of unconditional regret that I call it, that matches up to unconditional affirmation that does involve a determination of the will, something more like a conditional intention.
So that, I mean, you really would take it back. You will.
Yeah, that's right. You will.
You really would take it back.
You know that you couldn't do it over again, but contrary to fact, if you could do it over again, you would act otherwise.
So let's review here. There's a superficial regret, which is the kind I have.
That's all you have.
That's what John is.
That's all you have. Really.
Presents no problems or paradoxes, right? But then if we're a deeper human being, we will see that there's this deeper kind of regret that involves conditional intention that turns the whole thing paradoxical, and I should really feel bad for not adopting that concept. That's what you guys are telling me.
Well, no, because without adopting that, you get away with magical thinking and bad faith. That's what happens. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing regret with Jay Wallace from Berkeley, the author of The View from Here on Affirmation. And there's a question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Peter. I'm from San Francisco. So my question concerns the interplay between guilt and regret. I don't think I've heard anyone say anything about guilt. And I guess I'm wondering if guilt is always a precursor to regret. If you have guilt, does regret follow automatically? And maybe a sort of corollary question, if someone wasn't capable of feeling guilt, maybe a sociopath or something, does that mean that there is no regret?
Great. Yeah, I mean, this I think ties into Ken's earlier question about, you know, things that affect other people as opposed to merely self-regarding things that you might have done in the past. I think there is some regret that is not moral, doesn't necessarily involve guilt. You regret not going to that baseball game, which turned out to be really exciting. I don't think guilt would be appropriate in that case. And so you can have regret in that case without guilt. But, you know, guilt, I think, is a specifically moralized form of regret. It's connected to things like remorse, and especially where our past actions and our past immoral actions affect other people. You know, I think that it's the specific form that that regret tends to take.
Tell me about, there's a case you discuss in your book, which involves another person, but doesn't raise questions of guilt. I just want to illustrate that. Yeah. Guilt is a different thing from regret, a related thing, but a different thing.
Right.
And regret isn't just, I mean, the thing that distinguishes regret isn't just its self-regarding character. It can also be other-regarding without involving guilt. Because you discuss the case of, say, a 14-year-old girl, unprepared for motherhood, who engages in certain rash acts and has a child and has no means of supporting that child. And that looks like a mistake. Anybody advising her would say, that's a mistake. Maybe she herself comes to realize it's a mistake. She wasn't prepared for motherhood. She wasn't prepared to be a parent. The kid is born. She affirms the kid the way John affirms his oldest son, Jim. What help me think about that kind of case.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting kind of case because that brings out the kind of the way justification and retrospective regret can come apart. I don't think that was the right decision for her to make. It was both for moral reasons and for prudential reasons, you know. And so she ought not to have had a kid at that stage in her life. But once the child is on the scene, she's attached to the child, and I think that involves a kind of non-superficial form of affirmation that has this kind of intentional aspect. So she can't, knowing what she knows, regret the decision, even though it was the wrong thing to do.
Now, this sounds like something John would say, well, right, I don't have to reconcile these things. Here's a complicated way for a human being to be. I recognize that was the wrong decision, and in some ways, I regret that decision. But I affirm your existence. My regretting that decision does not undercut my affirmation of your existence, my dear child. Right? I mean, can't we hold those two things together? That's what John wants to say.
Yeah, I want to say, well, you can regret the act or the rashness that led to the act and say, well, I regret the act, but in fact, I don't regret the actual consequences it had.
These guys
are going to convince me there's an inconsistency there, but I don't see it.
When you say you regret the act, do you wish on balance you hadn't done it? Knowing that if you hadn't done it, your child wouldn't have existed.
That's my question. Yeah, I think I can regret the act and not take a position on that because I think that's a different attitude.
Yeah.
A very much more complicated and counterfactual and actually rather bizarre one.
I want to ask you about Nietzsche because John said he sniffed Nietzsche in my view. And I wonder if I'm sniffing Nietzsche in your view or not because Nietzsche talks about our relationship to the past.
Yeah.
And he has this eternal recurrence test that John mentioned. You know, the demon comes to you in the night and says, I'm going to give you your life again. Over and over and over to infinity in every detail, right? Would you scream or would you shout Hosanna with joy? You have lived well, he says, only if you would live this life over and over again to infinity in every detail. If you say, well, let me change this, let me change that, because I have regret, right? Then you haven't lived well. You haven't owned your life. I mean, I'm not sure. Tell me how your view relates to that Nietzschean conception of a well-lived life.
Well, you know, I think it's one root into that Nietzschean conception, or at least a part of that conception in some sense. You know, if this idea that is on the right lines, that the one that John categorically rejects, namely that to affirm something is to be prepared counterfactually to affirm its necessary causal and historical conditions, then, you know, for all we know, those conditions, you had some great examples of this at the beginning, they might include not just mistakes you've made or bad actions you've performed, but, you know, historical catastrophes or something like that, that are not, you know, remotely things that are, you know, positive or valuable events in world history. And yet, your affirmation of your life and the individuals in your life might commit you, seems to commit you, by the same logic to affirming on balance that these things...
Because, John, you want to kind of take the life, it sounds like, you want to take the life out of its historical context, out of the conditions that make that life possible and say, I take the life, but the rest of it, I don't take. Right? Nietzsche, I think, would say, you're not owning the life. You're trying to separate the life.
Yeah, well, I mean, Nietzsche has a good way of putting things so that you recognize that they're baloney. I mean, there's a difference between the past and the future, and some of these differences are inconvenient. Some of them are very lucky. If you're thinking about the future and you want something to happen, you you have some choice in the matter, you have to figure out how it's going to happen and how you're going to do things that make it happen. You have to choose a means that gets you to the end. But if you're happy with something now, you don't have to look back and make decisions about the past that lead to it. You can just look back and say, wow, that's interesting how we got here from there. But I don't have to take responsibility for that. I mean, Nietzsche is just silly. I mean,
but Jay's not silly.
No, Jay's not silly because he doesn't put things in such a... And you're not silly. You're respected colleagues, right? And I'm so glad that Senator Stanford was a robber baron and screwed thousands of Californians out of their hard-earned wealth so he could found a university, and that his son died of typhus in Europe,
exactly,
so that we could found a university and you could have a job. I'm just so happy about all that. You know, and Nietzsche would say, I'm inconsistent if I'm not happy about his son dying. That's bull.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
There we go.
Yeah, thanks. I'm going. You know, I have lots of individual regrets, but you know, I wonder, to escape that for just a second, I wonder if people can collectively have regrets like climate change. Like when, for example, with the current drought here in California, I sometimes, if I run the water too long, I start to regret that. And is it important that we use our regret for our future actions? I just wonder about that.
I think it makes perfect sense to regret things collectively, insofar as there are things that we're doing collectively that are regrettable. And one thing that might make them regrettable will be their future consequences. So I think this is a great example of something we're doing together, you know, as citizens of California, that's bad or unfortunate in virtue of what it's going to mean for future generations. And that's a reason why we should... Together, it would make sense for us to regret the thing that we've done and or are doing. And
John mentioned Nietzsche, and I mentioned Nietzsche. I want to mention another existentialist, Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah.
Because she says our attitude toward the past could only be an aesthetic attitude, and kind of for reasons that John says. It's all done and over. We have no more engagement with it. Our engagement is with the future, and we're trying to project ourselves into the future, not so much project ourselves into the past. And that would lead to a thought like John's.
Yeah.
Right, and I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, good point. I don't regret the afternoons I spent with Simone and Jean-Paul at the Café de Deux Magots discussing Edith Piaf, but go ahead.
This aesthetic attitude, she says, is not an attitude of engagement.
Yeah, well, that's just my point, actually, is that it's kind of a superficial attitude. And I think a lot of people, when they think about this young girl's child example, for instance, just to take that case, think it's perfectly natural to have the attitude looking back that you don't wish on balance you'd acted otherwise, despite the fact that it wasn't the right thing to have done at the time. And you know, there's a counterfactual question there. It's admittedly a hypothetical, but it's perfectly coherent, and we can form conditional intentions.
Now, does it follow from that if you had known at that time that this act would lead to a daughter that this young woman very much will value in 20 years when she grows up, that she would have gone ahead and done it?
Nope, it's not. I think
it doesn't follow.
No, it doesn't follow. I think justification and regret come apart in this way. It was perfectly predictable at the time that conceiving the child would have given birth to an individual your attachment to which would make you unable to regret the decision. But that's not a reason for doing it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about regret with Jay Wallace, author of The View from Here on Affirmation, Attachment, and the Limits of Regret.
The United States, as it is today, wouldn't exist without the elimination of millions of Native Americans through disease and conquest, or the enslavement of millions of Africans. Almost certainly everyone here at the Marsh today wouldn't be here, wouldn't exist without those things having happened. Does this mean if we're happy to be Americans, we can't regret those things, like my friends here say?
We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Yesterday the milk was spilled in the circle beneath the hill. Now today I understand the cruel laws of fairyland.
thanks to our live musical, and in this case, somewhat mystical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about regret with Jay Wallace from UC Berkeley, and we have a question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Claire from San Francisco. My question is, when no action can be taken for a mistake that we made, does the regret, especially repeated regret, serve as a form of self-punishment? Can we somehow feel like we are atoning for our mistake by repeatedly and repeatedly feeling the regret when no action can be taken to correct the behavior?
And are you regarding this as a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not quite sure.
It can go either way. If it gets overdone, it leads to depression, it goes downhill, it serves no purpose. But in a way, does someone somehow feel like they have paid their debt by punishing themselves with the feelings of regret?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that's a slightly funny attitude to take to yourself, that, you know, you're punishing yourself through this attitude. But I think that's a natural thing to think. I mean, my own take on it is just that it's the inevitable byproduct of being invested in things. You're kind of emotionally vulnerable in these ways. It's not so much that you're punishing yourself, you're giving expression to the fact that you care about something that you've, some value that you haven't lived up to or something.
I agree with Janet. I think that regret isn't self-punishment, but the analogy with self-punishment can be very helpful if you're discussing a person's problems with regret. And you say, well, why is it rational to produce more pain in yourself for having done this than you would produce in a third person if they had done something similar and it had reached the point of pointlessness? So I think it's a very good and rich analogy, but it's not quite the same.
I want to take it in a different direction, though, because the one word you said in passing, which I think is a really powerful word, was atonement, which reminds me of Nietzsche and my colleague. I have a colleague who writes and thinks a lot about Nietzsche, and he thinks Nietzsche's eternal recurrence test is about not atonement exactly, but redemption. And he thinks the point is that Nietzsche says, here's what it is to live your life well, to take the past with all of its horrors and pain and mistakes and make something of your current life that, as Lanier puts it, redeems the past. So it's not so much regret that's important, but it's an attitude toward the past that takes it as a task to redeem it. The past is the thing to be redeemed. And how do you do that? Well, suppose you made some terrible mistake, but you make of that mistake an opportunity for growth and learning, right? Such that if that opportunity would not have been possible except by your responding to the past. He uses Jimmy Carter's failure as president and what Jimmy Carter made of his failure. He made of his failure an amazing post-presidency. And he wouldn't have gotten to that point without making something of his past. And so that's to redeem the past. I mean, I'm not quite, that seems different from your view, but somehow related.
Yeah, I think there's a really important and interesting grain of truth there, which is that it's a very constructive attitude to take to your consciousness of something bad that you've done in the past to try to make the most out of the situation that you've brought into existence, to make something of it, to create something valuable out of it. But I guess I balk, though, at the idea of redemption, the idea, because I associate that, and I think there's a strain of this in Nietzsche as well, with his revaluation of values, that by making something positive out of the situation you've brought about, you somehow make it all right, what happened in the past. And I resist that conclusion.
Well, you don't
if you've wronged someone, you've harmed something valuable,
you don't make it all right. I mean, in a way, it doesn't have any, it has value and meaning only to the extent that you invested with a meaning in the context of your life, and you invested in the meaning in the context of your life in such a way that the whole life is now ownable by you, right? You make it an episode in a life that you can own. And I mean, that's why the eternal recurrence test is a test of whether you live well. Because did you take this horrible pass and make of this unfolding life a life that you can wholly own?
I'm all right with that, except the idea that that somehow redeems the bad thing. You've got to live up to the fact that it was a bad thing. And, you know, you're in this paradoxical situation where you're committed, in virtue of having made a life that you can affirm, to affirming the bad thing that gave rise to it.
I agree with Jay partly in not accepting what Nietzsche says, but I think I would go further. I mean, this whole idea, I mean, this puts such an obligation on us, particularly if you think, I not only regret some of the things I've done, but I regret all of the circumstances that make my life possible, or many of them. You know, going back not just to World War II and World War I and the potato famine, but probably if Alexander hadn't conquered Persia, which I'm sure he wasn't justified in doing. And now I'm supposed to, so here, you know, I want to get up, fix a nice breakfast for my wife, help my grandchildren with their tuition, help my kids in a little way, teach a good course. Oh, wait a minute. Add that all up. That doesn't even begin to redeem all this crap that made my life possible. You know, there's just too much Christianity left in Nietzsche for me. I don't have it. America will be doing well if it doesn't screw up the life of the next generation without worrying about doing it in such a splendid way that it makes up for all the slaves and dead Indians.
Yeah. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. Let's see if you can follow up on that.
Hi, I'm Devin. I live in San Francisco.
You're who?
I'm Devin.
Oh.
Mostly, I think it sounds like you've been talking about people having regret and how or how not to reconcile that with whatever went down or will go down afterward. What about the type of people who really seem to never express any regrets, say members of a certain presidential administration or most of today's political class vis-a-vis climate change, who don't seem to think we're doing anything wrong by not doing it? What do you do about someone's complete apparent lack of regret?
Jay says those are shallow people, right?
Yeah, I think they often deny reality. They're not facing up to the facts about what they've done and about what has been caused by what they've done.
Let me ask you a question then on their side, sort of. I like to say to students, the past is a ghost. The past, okay, tradition has no sway over you. Your life begins now. Some people think that's a kind of temporal parochialism, but I think, well, no, that's a ghost. The only way it can normatively force you is by your allowing it to, through things like regret and inhibition that says, oh, that's tradition, I can't go against a baloney, right? I mean, I have this sort of more Sartrean thing. I start now, right? And the past, where does the past get this power to make me regret it? It's over, it's done, move on. I mean, if there are other people out there trying to hold me to the past, okay, then I can either say, well, I'll let you hold me to that or not, right?
You're starting to sound like John now, another superficial
No, I'm just trying to understand what, because I think there's a fundamental question of how the past gets its power to, as it were, obligate you or command regret from you.
Well, I think it's just realism, you know, facing up to what you did and what has happened in the past and how that affects the things that you value and you care, the things that you care about.
Why don't I just observe, this is what I did.
Yeah.
Okay. This is where I am now. I did that.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like the character in Native Son when he finally owns up. Right. He says, I killed because of what I am. Okay. I did that. Okay. I acknowledge I did it. But now I move on. Why is that a superficial attitude rather than not letting my life be held hostage to the past?
Yeah.
Not requiring myself to redeem the past, but just to move on.
I think it's just built into this natural human attitude of attachment or valuing things that you create hostages to the past. That, you know, depending on how things go, you're vulnerable moving forward to look back on them with regret.
Okay, I think
so. I just don't. You. I think the Stoics wanted us to move towards a different way of living, which is kind of lighter on the earth. So
it's the attachment thing.
It's the attachment.
I mean, but you think it comes with being a human being as such. That is, you might think of it this way. I don't know if you do think of it this way. You might think of it this way. Look, my life is this temporally unfolding thing.
Yeah.
There's a future I anticipate. There's a past that I have to narrate into my present, right? I narrate my present as emerging, and there was something I was up to, right? I was trying to become a philosopher. I was trying not to become, right? And that narration kind of is in normative terms or something like that. And as if I'm going to narrate this continuing life, the past has to be an episode in it, so I have to come to terms with it, so I can't just walk away. I mean, is that like, because I'm a being in time, to use a Heideggerian kind of phrase, life unfolding over time, and I value each stage of my life?
Well, I think it's partly that. That was you who did that bad thing in the past. You can't just detach from that as the members of certain recent administrations might seem to be trying to do sometimes, right? And pretend that you had nothing to do with it. You also have to face up to the facts about what you did, not be living in denial about that. And if those facts involve ways in which your actions brought about, damaged things that are valuable and that you're invested in.
In fairness to Cheney, I don't think he's a consistent non-regretter. I think he truly regrets shooting that guy in the face. But what bothers us is really...
Didn't the other guy apologize?
not so much that he doesn't regret, but that he hasn't taken the step necessary to regret, which is admit that he did something wrong.
Well, Jay, this has been a great conversation. I regret no parts of it, but I do regret that it has to come to an end, and I'm going to thank you for joining.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Our guest has been Jay Wallace, a professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley, a stone's throw from here, and author of the very fine book, The View from Here, on Affirmation, Attachment, and the Limits of Regret. So, John, what are your thoughts about regret now? Are there any regretful thoughts?
Well, I was just so glad when you started the show and you said it was about regret, because a week ago when you told me, I thought you said egret. And I've spent the whole week reading about herons and egrets and terns, and I just couldn't see anything of deep philosophical interest there. But regret turns out to have been a very rich and interesting topic. So I somewhat regret my week spent studying birds, but I don't regret at all our conversation. And I hope I was able to illuminate you and Jay about some of the mistakes you're making.
I think it's a fascinating topic. I think we need to think more about redeeming the past. But I take your point that that's maybe too demanding. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, a man who can't regret things fast enough, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, regret is a weird thing. It covers a lot of ground, even ground it doesn't cover. For instance, I can not only regret killing a man, I can regret that I won't be able to make it to your birthday party. See what regret did there? It apologized for an activity that did happen and for one that will not happen. I wish I could go back in time and undo a murder on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't want to do anything. Still, even by not doing, I can do something. I can add the birthday party I won't be attending to the list of things undone, like bungee jumping, having a menage a trois, or learning to juggle. My life is full of these kinds of regrets. Literary critics are fond of using the word regrettable, as in, say, the author has a regrettable tendency to overdevelop minor characters. I just bought a book called The League of Regrettable Superheroes about actual unsuccessful comic book superheroes of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, including Dr. Vampire, Bozo the Iron Man, Brain Boy, the Red Bee, and Spider Queen. But who is it who finds these superheroes regrettable? The artists who created them? The readers at the time? Readers now? Can you impose regret? And if a book is called regrettable, can you force an author to feel regret for what the critic thinks are shortcomings? When I was in college, one of my teachers informed me as I was sitting at my desk that my trousers were regrettable. The trousers in question were bell-bottom jeans I'd taken from my roommate who was going to throw them away. They were awesome. So many patches, the original denim was pretty much gone. Do I regret having worn them? Of course not. I wouldn't wear them now. I've evolved into more of a fedora, shark skin, and wraparound shade sort of person. But at the time, I was the very model of a modern major dude, in a hippie kind of way. I recently listened to a public radio interview by a newscaster with a man who had been a victim in the Boston Marathon bombing. I won't name names, and I'll exaggerate the interview, but basically, because of his status as a victim, you might say, he just had a book published, which had been optioned for a television special. He'd gotten married, had reconciled with his estranged family, and he was going to have a baby. And the newscaster recounted all that and then asked him if he ever thought he'd be so lucky, to which the man said, almost apologetically, "Well, you know, I did get my leg blown off." To which the newscaster smilingly said, of course, and glossed over that part, seeming to me to be a bit peeved at the guy for not fully appreciating the media attention his misfortune had bestowed upon him. The point being, did the newscaster express regret for her little faux pas? Of course not. She's a newscaster. Newscasters save their regrets for their memoirs if they're lucky enough to get a book deal. And even then, like Frank Sinatra, they'll make a point of having too few regrets to mention. Unless you're like me, so thick with regret of things undone that actual experience can no longer penetrate. Kind of like the patches on the ancient bell bottoms, come to think of it. All regret, no denim. Which will be a good title for my memoirs. But I would immediately regret it. I gotta go.
Thank you.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarais. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Kelly Witters, Orr Gazal, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed, or sometimes misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.